Welcome back to the Bama Beat. I'm Ben Jones here with Cecil Hurt today. We're wrapping up our series looking back at all the coaches in between Paul Bear Bryant and Nick Saban. We've actually covered all the coaches in between Coach Bryant and Coach Saban, which means that today we're just going to be looking at some of the coaching search for Nick Saban, some of the other candidates that were considered. We're also going to reflect on some of the lessons that were learned that kind of came up time and time again during all these other podcasts. If you wanted to go back and listen to those before you listen to this one, I'd recommend that. It's a really good series. We've gotten a lot of positive feedback about it. We also have a few questions from some of you guys who wanted to know a little bit more about some stuff that we either glossed over or just skipped as we covered the course of about 25 years in probably about 3.5 hours of podcasts, give or take. Right, Cecil?
Something like.
We're efficient with our time.
We are.
Yeah. Great clock management. But for now, we can go ahead and just start talking about the coaching search that led to Nick Saban. One of the things that I thought, looking back at the timeline, Nick Saban wasn't hired at Alabama or wasn't introduced until something like January 9th or 10th
right.
of 2007. And I wonder if that would fly in 2019 or 2015, or if there would be such an uproar, if people wouldn't understand what was happening, if they'd be so concerned about recruiting, if all these things were happening, that you would have felt like you had to hire someone before Christmas. Do you think that that would be possible at this point?
There would be an uproar, I think. And I wrote at the time, once the Rich Rodriguez situation was over with, they're all in on Saban, and you're going
right.
to wait as long as you have to wait. And if you end up with Nick Saban, it was the right move.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't, you ended up with somebody else and have to see how it had worked out. But I think most people at the time, first of all, you get a little Christmas break, and that helps a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I think most people at the time understood, and I certainly wrote a column trying to make it clear that the move at that point was not to move until you got an answer one way or the other, which wasn't going to happen until the NFL season, until the Dolphins season was over.
Yeah.
And you could get all bent out of shape about it and say, can't wait that long. Oh, my gosh, it's December the 26th and got to do something, when you might have had Nick Saban if you wait a week. You know, if you wait until the Dolphin season's over mm-hmm. and he can handle it that way, then you've got a chance. One wasn't a guarantee, but you've got a chance to get Nick Saban, which was the whole point of getting involved in the thing in the first place for a lot of people.
Yeah.
It wasn't just a random surge.
Now, but one thing that I'm not quite sure about, and I don't know how we would classify this as a question, would you say that Nick Saban was the number one candidate for Alabama going into this? Because there was a lot of fan interest in Steve Spurrier, who'd just gotten back to South Carolina at the time, hadn't really gotten South Carolina rolling like he would a few years later. And we can talk about this now. Rich Rodriguez, was he offered the job? Did he accept the job? Because if so, that happened before Saban would have been offered the job officially, right?
Three things happen. First of all, now in 2019,
mm-hmm.
no matter who you ask, they were all for Nick Saban. You know,
yeah.
You're not going to find
the revisionist history portion of this.
Yeah, you're not going to find the Rich Rodriguez guys.
We should go back and dig up some of these old message board posts from people who were in favor of Steve Spurrier coming to Alabama.
People like activity,
mm-hmm.
But you also have factions. Everywhere has factions. Everybody has their own agenda out there. There was a fairly significant group, I wouldn't say a large group, because I don't think he entertained a lot of opinions, but people who he did listen to. Who, like I said, whose attitude from the beginning of the search, or even from the point where Mike Shula wasn't going to be retained, was that Nick Saban was head and shoulders the best candidate available,
mm-hmm.
and was an absolute coaching machine who had won national championship at LSU and could win a national championship at Alabama. And it's very rare in any coaching search, just like this year in all the football coaching searches or basketball coaching searches, for that candidate to even be available to you.
Yeah.
It's a rare set of circumstances.
But
so
at the same time,
there were some people, and you know, I know some who were absolute Nick Saban absolutists from the minute there was a search to be had.
Mm-hmm.
That until he told you no, until that was no longer a possibility, I mean real no, until that was no longer a possibility, that was the best option. That everything else, whether it was Rich Rodriguez or Steve Spurrier or whoever, was leaving the best guy on the table.
Yeah.
Now, were there people, you know, first of all, Steve Spurrier, good coach, great, Hall of Fame coach, mm-hmm. you know. Would you have encountered some of the same issues that he had at South Carolina? Well, you know, Alabama's a better job than South Carolina.
Yep.
But would he have gotten tired of recruiting, et cetera, et cetera? Who knows? He'd have won football games. You know, I'm not critical of Steve Spurrier. I just don't know that that was a time that he was going to make a move like that, or that Alabama was really a place that was a fit for him.
Yeah.
I think the Rich Rodriguez thing came up because there was also a group of people who either knew Rich, felt like they would have some influence with him, or were just panicked that Saban wasn't going to come, that, you know, he had said whatever, you know, the Miami media.
He said, I'm not going to be the Alabama
head coach, which, you know, you can interpret that. That's the language of negotiation.
Would it be?
So anyway, yeah, they, you know, Mal, probably, there was probably an offer that he could have accepted. I don't know if it was.
Meaning Rich Rodriguez.
Yeah, Rich Rodriguez. I don't know if it was an enthusiastic offer on Mal's part, but, mm-hmm. You know, like everybody else, you get 2-3 weeks into it and you feel like, well, hey, maybe there's a bird in the hand here, and this guy's had an undefeated season at Tulane and done well at West Virginia.
Yeah, it was 10-2 that season. It was 10-2. One win away from being in the national championship
right,
game.
Right. There were now the earlier group of people I talked about who were Saban absolutists,
mm-hmm.
didn't want Rich and were glad that it worked out the way that it did.
Yeah. Now, there, it seems to me, again, from the outside looking in, that there, if you're doing the coaching search and you're gauging interest, then you're probably not reaching out to just one person initially. It seems like there were probably folks who reached out to Nick Saban, probably folks who reached out to Rich Rodriguez, perhaps to Steve Spurrier.
Mm-hmm.
Well.
No, definitely to Steve Spurrier.
Other names that were tossed around during this that we can mention briefly, Paul Johnson. Was he at Georgia Tech by then?
Or he was. Okay. He was. I think that was more people who were sentimental about running the wishbone.
Which is another thing that makes Steve Spurrier kind of interesting to me. Because Alabama's never had an offense like what Steve Spurrier had, or at least at that point hadn't. Bobby Petrino at Louisville had also been coming off a very good season.
Yeah, I think that his flirtation with Auburn did not help him.
No. He flirted with a lot.
He did.
People.
And I think his reputation was starting to
fray.
Precede him at that point, although he certainly went on to have some good years at Arkansas.
Yes.
So again, good football coach. I don't know that
right.
he would have been a fit. And Jeff Tedford, I think. Who
a year removed from having Aaron Rodgers, I believe.
Yeah, and was a hot name. And then didn't work out for him at Cal, but I think that has more to do with what kind of job Cal is mm-hmm. than Jeff Tedford, who's gone on to do a tremendous job at Fresno State.
Right.
So
Some folks also were really excited about Bob Stoops, although I don't know how serious Alabama would have been about him or how serious he would have been about Alabama.
It would have been hard to get him away from Oklahoma at that point.
Yeah. So anyway, what I was trying to say, from the outside looking in, it seems as though if you're reaching out to some of these guys initially, and it sounds like Nick Saban probably said no, or, you know, I'm not interested, or at the very least, I'm not interested right now, we need to get to the end of the season, which would have then put the onus back on Alabama to look at Rich Rodriguez, Steve Spurrier, other candidates, which is probably where you get the press conference with Nick Saban saying, I'm not going to be the Alabama coach. After, like you said, there was potentially an offer extended to Rich Rodriguez, and then it fell through, then the ball is again kind of back in Alabama's court at that point. And that's really when things turned to Saban, right? That's when it became Saban or bust.
Right.
Was this kind of the point where, and I don't know if it was Mal Moore's opinion that Nick Saban was the only candidate at that point, or if it was the opinion of the other people who had always held that opinion, is that the point where those folks were kind of able to assert their will in this and say, no, we're running this and we're going to make Nick Saban tell us no before we do anything else?
I think there was always a situation where it's like playing ragtime on the piano. You know, one hand, right hand's playing a melody, but the left hand, which I would say were some of Nick's representatives, people who had contact with him, they never stopped playing the same thing. You know, the melody, all that. I'm not going to be the Alabama head coach, and the stuff you have to do in public was one thing, but I don't think the other hand ever stopped playing the same tune.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, no matter what was being said publicly about, no, it's not going to happen, et cetera, et cetera, I don't think that on the other hand, that absolute no ever came.
Yeah.
So, after the Rich Rodriguez thing, I think Mal, who's passed away and can't speak for himself,
did write a book before he passed away.
He did. But I think at that point, he felt like he had given factions that didn't want to wait on Nick, he had given them their shot,
right? You know,
and he was going to do what some people had been advising him to do all along.
Yeah.
And what I think was his inclination all along, frankly, but I can't speak for him.
Now, the canon, or kind of the accepted history of this, seems to say that there were several parts that played a role in eventually getting Nick Saban to Alabama. You know, one of those being Mal Moore flew down to Miami and met with him and gave him the final pitch. There's at least one story out there where, you know, Mal Moore told him, you've got to come back with me. They're going to fire me if I don't do this.
I don't think Nick would worry about that.
No.
Too bad.
You know, there's stories about Miss Terry decided that she'd be much happier in a place like Tuscaloosa than in Miami, or that Terry and Nick together decided they could impact lives more, as he said, more at the college level than at the NFL level. Nick has also talked about being able to have 7 first-round draft picks in a recruiting class to Alabama, whereas with the Dolphins, you only get 1 in the NFL every year.
Right.
Also, there was a pretty significant offer on the table there. What do we think? Was there any one factor in there that turned things in Alabama's favor, or was it probably a combination of all those? Were there any that we didn't mention?
The money was always going to be enough. You know, whatever you defined as enough. That wasn't an issue per se. I mean, there are negotiations.
Right.
You don't want to overpay, or you don't want to accept a contract that's undervalues you, but that was always going to be worked out. I do think that Miami's a little bit different place to live, and I think that the Sabans are probably more comfortable in a college-type environment.
There's no lakes in Miami.
Well, they kind of are, but not of the sort that they would. And there's a lot going on in Miami. You know, there's a lot, and it's a great city. I like Miami, but living there would be a different kind of experience. I think that he liked the idea that in the In the NFL, your roster is tied to many things that include a draft, the willingness of others to spend on free agents. Whereas in college football, there's a fairly direct relationship between how hard you work and the kind of roster that you have. Mm-hmm. And if in his mind, and I think he'd still tell you this, if he is willing to work twice as hard in recruiting as somebody else is, he's going to get better players.
Yeah.
And so I think that he likes that scenario.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, in Miami or any other NFL franchise, New Orleans, Washington, you work hard and you scout, but you're getting one first rounder, like you said.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot longer time to change a roster.
Yeah. There's also the great what if of whether Miami's medical staff had cleared Drew Brees and they'd signed Drew Brees instead of Dante Culpepper, then who knows how it would have been. Nick Saban, I think, has been on the record saying he wanted Drew Brees over Dante Culpepper.
Yeah, I think that's true.
You think it's true that he's been on the record? You think he did want Drew Brees?
I don't know that he's been on the record saying I wanted A rather than B.
I think he has.
But I think every time you ask him a question that's in any way related to Drew Brees, if you can work it into the conversation, you realize. Yeah.
I wonder if some
that he wanted Drew Brees. Yeah.
I wonder if some of that is revisionist, like you said. It's hard to go back and find the people in 2019 who wanted Rich Rodriguez over Nick Saban, just right. Like it would be hard to go back and find the folks Dante who argued for Dante Culpepper over Drew Brees.
Sure.
So that's going to wrap up how Alabama landed Nick Saban. We're going to get to some of these questions. We'll have some lessons learned as well from this whole thing. One thing I wanted to mention that we skipped over, I think Dabo Swinney is usually attributed to being part of Gene Stallings' coaching tree because that's where he got his coaching start.
Yeah,
played
he
for most
played
of his
for
career.
Him. Yeah.
But it's important to mention that Dabo's first year at Alabama as a walk-on in 1989 was Bill Curry's last year, and his position coach that season was Terry Bowden.
No, Tommy. Tommy. Was it
Tommy?
Tommy Bowden. Tommy Bowden.
Who ended up hiring... Yeah, Terry was the one at Auburn. I'm sorry. Tommy, who ended up hiring him at Clemson as his wide receivers coach, and that's what gives you Dabo Swinney at Clemson when he'd been selling real estate in Birmingham before that.
Right. So. Tommy liked him. You know, he'd coached him, liked him, brought him in to coach receivers, obviously, but mainly to be the recruiting coordinator.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why when Alabama pounded Clemson, I guess you can use that word, in the 2008 opener, and eventually led to Tommy's midseason dismissal, mm-hmm. Dabo would name the interim to hold a recruiting class together.
Yeah.
That was the reason. I don't, credit to Terry Don Phillips. You know, he certainly ended up hiring an outstanding coach, but I think his short-term thought was they didn't want to lose all the recruits.
Yeah. So. Alabama set itself up to lose two national championship games to Dabo Swinney. If they just hadn't smoked Clemson back in 2008, imagine where the dynasty could be right now.
Law of unintended consequences.
Yeah. Ben. This is the butterfly effect of college football.
Absolutely.
Speaking of the butterfly effect, one of the questions that we got was looking back at the end of the Gene Stallings era and the defensive coordinator from that, Bill Oliver, who may have believed that he was going to be named the head coach after Gene Stallings had retired. That did not come to pass. It ended up being Mike Dubose, another defensive coach for Alabama at that point. And if you listen to the Mike Dubose podcast, we talk about there being some different factions on the coaching staff and there not being a lot of cohesion there. Do you think that Bill Oliver was at one point expecting to be the head coach and then was not based on what happened with the administration?
I think he was. I wasn't privy to the conversation, so I'm not going to say how definitive that was. But I think as long as Hootie Ingram was the athletic director, I think that Bill felt like he had a very good chance to be the next head coach when Gene stepped down.
Right.
Now, things didn't work out, and Hootie resigned after the NCAA situation, and so whatever promise was or was not made was obviously off the table.
Right.
So
I wonder if that had happened. Certainly, it would have been different in some ways if Mike Dubose than if Mike Dubose became head coach. I don't know how different it would have been. Bill Oliver had a little bit of head coaching experience at Tennessee Chattanooga. Was not a guy who was had a wealth of head coaching experience. And if there's one common thread that we've seen through all of these, it's that it's really tough for a guy without head coaching experience at Alabama.
Right, but Bill was older, you know, than Mike. Bill's probably 12, 13 years older than Mike was. So he had that much more experience, that many more connections and so forth. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, you know, he got the interim job at Auburn and had mixed success
there.
So Bill's an outstanding football coach. He certainly would have had that going for him, and I think a lot of Alabama fans would have supported him. And he might not have made some of the mistakes that Mike Dubose made, but to sit here and say, oh, he'd have won this or he'd have won that, you don't know.
Yeah.
There's no way to know.
Oliver proving that all of these coaching lines are interconnected and interwoven, became head coach at Auburn after Terry Bowden resigned. That's
right,
my name's in my notes here. Terry Bowden's name is written down, which is how I got a little bit
correct. And was really Bill was really the mentor for Jeremy Pruitt.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Because Bill was defensive coordinator when Jeremy was a walk-on.
Yeah. Bill Oliver sounds like he's still alive as well.
He is.
Wikipedia tells me he's 79 years old.
Alive, kicking, and I talk to Bill every couple of times a year.
That's good.
So,
One other question that we got from a listener. We didn't mention the story of the brick that was thrown to the window of Bill Curry's office at some point during his tenure. Do you have some of the background on the story, or should I pull it up here?
Well, we broke the story. We didn't break the window, but we broke the story. If you go to the Tuscaloosa News, I can't remember if it was probably in Monday's paper. It probably wasn't in Sunday's. You know, they lost to Ole Miss on Saturday.
It was 1988.
Yeah, they lost the homecoming game to Ole Miss.
Had been up 12-0 in the third quarter, lost the game 22-12.
Didn't complete.
Ole Miss had scored two touchdowns in the game's last minute to lose.
Alabama didn't complete a pass.
Yeah.
In the game. But anyway, all those circumstances aside, it's probably Monday's paper, but it was late Saturday or Sunday. Now, if you go back in the archives and look up that story, the headline says rock thrower breaks Curry's window. I don't know at what point it evolved from a rock to a brick. I never saw
the
object.
Maybe it's in the basement of the Bryant Museum.
So my memory is that initially Bill told me it was a rock, but it could, you know, you could say rock and it'd be a brick. Then you got all kind of, you know, and Bill, people were so at that point, you know, they were so divided over Bill, and there were people who believe to this day, it's almost like the Zapruder film, that the window was broken from the inside out, rather than, you know, that the glass shatter pattern was outside instead of inside the office. We did not go over with a forensic team. You know, if Bill said somebody threw a rock and broke his window, we wrote that somebody threw a rock and broke his window. And many people have taken credit for being the rock thrower. You'd have to have a pretty good arm.
Revisionist history.
You've seen The Office. You know where it is.
The joke afterwards was that none of the quarterbacks could have done it, right?
Exactly.
There were no passes completed.
No passes completed in the game. Those were the suspects who were immediately eliminated.
Yeah.
You'd have to be, if you'd been out, you know, in venting your post game frustration on the strip at one of the establishments and decided you were so mad that you were going to go throw a rock or a brick, you'd have to be a pretty good brick thrower. They've changed, you know, since they've added the weight room and football connected the practice facility. The windows aren't exactly the same. It's not like Dealey Plaza where you can reconstruct every every step, but you could see that it's a pretty high window.
And yeah, I believe it's now the athletic director's office, right?
It is. Yeah, it's Greg Burns' office, and so to get it up on that second floor at the correct angle with the right force to break a window, you'd have to have a pretty good arm.
Yeah, the version of the story that I read said that it was the facilities manager or someone similar who came into the office early on Sunday morning with the film that had been developed from the game, because back then you had film, it wasn't digital, for the coaches to review on Sunday. And when he came in, he saw on the floor of Bill Curry's office, saw the glass and saw the brick or the rock, whatever it was. And then Bill Curry came in a few hours later to break down film and was told about it at that point. This probably goes along a lot.
Yeah, Bill may not have ever seen if it was a brick or a rock.
It might have been gone by the time he was there.
Gone by the time he got there.
This probably goes along with if you go back.
There was a broken window. I did see a broken window.
Okay. Because there's some folks who say that the story was made up, or that, you know, I don't know if there's any folks who are so far as
Curry
threw it.
Right.
Maybe,
exactly. There's all kinds of those. But the one thing I can tell you is there was a broken window.
Okay.
Because that I saw.
This probably goes along with, if you go back and listen to the Bill Curry podcast, we mentioned that when he left for Kentucky, a big feeling of it was probably feeling underappreciated at Alabama. And you have objects thrown through your window that will tend to engender those kinds of feelings, perhaps.
Possibly.
Two interesting what-ifs here, one of which someone asked us to talk about a little bit more. The possibility of Alabama hiring Oklahoma State coach Les Miles after Dennis Franchione left for Texas A&M. How serious was that? Did that get very far?
I think he was just one of the names that was out there. You know, I don't know that Les ever came in and interviewed. Probably would have been a good candidate.
Yeah.
You know, I think I'll exempt Mike Gundy, who's a different kind of cat, it seems like, but I imagine the Oklahoma State job is a frustrating job, being 70 miles from Oklahoma. There's just probably limits to the success you're going to have. Oklahoma's a playoff team this year. Oklahoma State may or may not get there one year, but I think LSU or Alabama would have been, as LSU turned out to be, I think Alabama would have been very intriguing to Les Miles.
Yeah.
Probation or no probation. Les seems like the kind of guy that wouldn't worry about that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
If you'll take Kansas, you're not worried about issues.
Yeah. That's one of the two really fascinating what-ifs that we've discussed at some point on this podcast. The other one goes all the way back to the Ray Perkins podcast, where we talked about other potential replacements for Coach Bryant. And to me, the most intriguing candidate that could have coached Alabama that did not, probably through this whole process, is Pat Dye. Because at that point, you really change the complexion, not just of Alabama and not just of Auburn, but perhaps of college football as a whole. Even if Pat Dye comes to Alabama and has a similar career to what Ray Perkins had, then you're talking about a very different Auburn program. You're talking about the possibility of, you know, Jimbo Fisher and Terry Bowden at Auburn not being there. There's a lot of differences that could have happened if Pat Dye had chosen, you know, no, Alabama is the job that I want, and I'm going to wait and take that job when Coach Bryant retires.
There's a lot of people, and Coach Bryant never told me this, so it's sitting in a firsthand thing. I don't know if Pat's said it or not. Said a lot of people say that Pat's said it, but that Coach Bryant had told Pat that if he'd stay at Wyoming one more year, he would have a good shot at it. I won't say guaranteed it to him, but he had essentially told him if he went to Auburn, that was it. You know, he couldn't get the Alabama job from
Which
Auburn.
Makes sense, just politically.
Yeah, right. And so, without saying that Coach Bryant guaranteed him the job, a lot of people think that he told Pat that in his opinion, his Coach Bryant's opinion, Pat would be wise to spend one more year at Wyoming.
Yeah. Okay, that I think covers all the questions that we had sent in from folks who listened. Thank you guys for doing that. We appreciate it. We're going to wrap this up with some lessons learned throughout the whole process of this. for me, maybe Cecil has a different opinion. Lesson number one is that you really need to have some head coaching experience when you become the head coach at Alabama. It's not one of those jobs where you want to be learning as you go along.
Certainly, if you rank or if you look at the coaches, the ones who did have, the ones who didn't have were Mike Dubose and Mike Shula.
Right.
You know, and they both, it was tough for them.
Yes.
It was difficult for them. Then you can, the others had, at some level, Ray did not have college experience, but he had NFL, mm-hmm. been the Giants head coach. So I think that experience helped him. Now, Gene Stallings wasn't wildly successful,
coach, yeah,
you know, but he had been both college and the NFL, and so he had learned a lot,
mm-hmm.
I think, at A&M and with the Cardinals. So, and obviously was successful by any standard other than the Bryant Saban standard.
Yeah, you know? You guys gave him a B.
Yeah.
Which I'm still a little bit incredulous about. There's probably, what, like 60 college football coaches of all time who've won a national championship, and you just gave one of them a B?
Right, and won seven, you know, and it wasn't even a Larry Coker championship. You know,
yeah.
It wasn't like he inherited a great team and then kind of ran it in the ground. They were still good when Gene retired. You know, Fran's experience at TCU was different. He'd had a lot of experience at Pittsburgh State. He'd been a head coach a mm-hmm. long time. Didn't have SEC experience, but I think Fran could have been successful. I don't think the things that kept Fran from being successful equated to him not having head coaching experience, which he had.
Right.
I think that helped him.
Mike Price
wasn't here long enough.
Yeah.
He had plenty of experience.
You could make the argument that he didn't have coaching experience in a situation like Alabama, which was part of his problem
was cultural.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't. He could have been head coach at Washington State for 20 years, and it wasn't going to prepare him to be at Alabama.
Yeah.
You know, Gene had been in the SEC as an assistant at Alabama,
mm-hmm.
and A&M culturally is not like the difference in A&M and Alabama is not like the difference in Washington State and Alabama or Pittsburgh State and Alabama. So I think he understood things here.
Nick, you have the microscope, yeah.
Yeah, Nick obviously had been at LSU
mm-hmm.
And knew what the SEC was, and Coach Bryant had been in the SEC before.
Yeah.
And had been at A&M, if you want to make that analogy, but had been at Kentucky and knew what football in this part of the country, in this particular setting, was about. So I think there is a value to that.
Yeah. The other lesson that I had coming out of it, and I certainly want to hear if you have any, is that hiring a disciple of the previous coach or of Coach Bryant, in this case, is no guarantee of success. I don't know that Ray Perkins was appreciably better than Bill Curry was. Gene Stallings certainly was very successful. But hiring Mike Dubose was not a guarantee of continuing Gene Stallings' success. And hiring Mike Shula was not a guarantee that you'd return Alabama back to where it was when he was a player either.
Well, and that's not exclusive to Alabama. They've had the same sorts of issues that
but it should perhaps be considered when Saban leaves that you don't automatically say, let's go find the guy with the most connections to Nick Saban.
Right. That hadn't necessarily worked at Ohio State. You know, they're trying it again at Nebraska,
mm-hmm.
And we'll see. And obviously Tom Osborne was an assistant to Bob Devaney, and you know, so that did.
Right.
There's an instance where it did work out, and it can work out, but
it's not a guarantee, not a guarantee is the way I worded it.
No,
yeah.
Yeah.
Any other lessons that you'd have coming out of this? Now that we've laid out 25 years in the last 4 hours or so?
No, probably that I'm too old to do another coaching search. That's for sure. I've learned that lesson.
Yeah. So. Let's hope that there's not one for a while. So, That's a good way to end this. Thank you to all of you guys who listened to this and shared it with your friends. We're really glad you guys have enjoyed this. We're thinking about what the next series of podcasts is that we're going to do during the summer when we have a little bit more time. Hopefully, we'll be able to share that with you guys soon. So thank you for listening. Until next time, this is the Bama Beat.